Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers, a one-hour analysis of the news. It's broadcast number 731, December the 9th, 1985. Yesterday was the fifth anniversary since the murder of John Lennon. A group of people met in New York City at Central Park, and they remembered the anniversary of his murder around a mosaic that was made in Italy with the word imagine made into the stone and set into the park. Imagine is the title of a song of John Lennon's. I think that it's significant that it be placed there, and it's a very beautiful thing because society cannot live without its dreams. Dreams are the things that make life worthwhile and happen, and without them we become actually less than human. People need those dreams, and Lennon dared to dream or imagine a world without wars. We know this isn't going to happen, but it's a dream, and it does suggest the chance that boundaries can be erased or differences erased and that people could get along. Whether you wipe out entire towns like Nagasaki or Hiroshima, or you put a single bullet into one individual, the pain is just as great, and sometimes it brings a tear to think about the single bullet as much as the expansion of the large nuclear movement. We certainly have lost some of the best and brightest people in the United States, silenced by the single bullet. December 14th, this next Saturday, is also the anniversary of the death of Bonnie Brussel. She was killed in an accident in 1970, December 14th. She went with us to Candlestick Park to see the last performance of the Beatles. She wasn't alive to meet John Lennon in 1972. Paul Krasner got the money to get out the first article that I ever published, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, from John and Yoko Lennon. Many of you know that. They gave him the money to get that out. And that article is a three-part story on the links of Watergate to going back to the Kennedy assassination, to the American assassins, the marriage of Alan Dulles to Nazi Reinhard Gehlen. This was 13 years ago, and how Nixon really got to power, his role with Nazis and Project Paperclip. Bernard Fensterwald, who I'm going to refer to later on this broadcast, who heads a committee in Washington and is a CIA attorney, he represents currently Marianne Paisley, whose husband had a role in the Soviet Union relationship with Lee and Marina Oswald as spies of Navy intelligence. He also was the attorney at Watergate for James McCord, and McCord's relationship to E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy and Donald Segretti is well known through Watergate history. And Donald Segretti, the head of the Dirty Tricks team for Richard Nixon, was the attorney at Fort Ord, working with Army law, quotes, law. At Fort Ord, the accident where Bonnie was killed took place just several miles outside of Fort Ord, and it involved a soldier from Fort Ord who left immediately for Salt Lake City and, of course, has never been sought or he never came back. Now, I'm just going to mention a few items in the news very quickly, and then the bulk of this program is on one of the current spy stories. There's so many, but I'm going to zero in on one of particular interest to material that we have shared in the past and things to look for in the future. First, I just want to mention the swine flu stories that came out in the news this week. A professor from Stanford University got, through Freedom of Information, details on the swine flu shots, because here was a situation where millions of people in America were told that they needed these shots. 45 million people received the vaccine. And now from Stanford University, this professor has said, his name is Barton Bernstein, he has said that the documents prove that there was absolutely no reason for the swine flu vaccines, that President Ford made the decision, because he was politically motivated. He was going to run for president the next year, and he wanted to appear to be protecting us or giving us his best advice. He was a lawyer. He was also a member of the Warren Commission, who covered up the murder of John Kennedy. So given that fact, what would you expect from him telling you to line up for shots? The Center for Disease Control described his campaign at the time as a medical Vietnam, interestingly enough. And the facts about swine flu are just barely released in the newspaper this week, San Francisco Examiner. As I say, 45 million people had the shot. There were 500 cases of Guillain-Barré paralyzing syndrome, 32 deaths, $135 million for the vaccination cost, $140 million in lawsuits. That's $270 million across the country. And it seems, according to the papers that have been released, this particular program was embroiled in politics in an election year in which a lackluster incumbent, Ford, was seen as being inept. He seized on this program to transform his image, and this is why he had these people go through it. Now, my second husband, after I divorced him, he remarried. He married a woman who lined up along with the other people and got the swine flu vaccine. And the next day, right after that, she began to get sick, and shortly she was paralyzed. They told her she had a form of Lou Gehrig disease. It followed immediately upon the time of the swine flu, and then she was bedridden, and she had multiple surgeries, and she died from it just about 2 years ago. And the Blue Cross pay for her care added up, for this is one individual, to $1 million. Now, I'm not talking about what happened to all the other people who were paralyzed or the lawsuits. I'm talking about my ex-husband, and his former wife was a close friend of mine. We grew up together and were very close friends at one time until I went off to Stanford, but we kept up the association. So I'm talking about one person who lined up, and goodness knows how many more had, as I say, 32 deaths, but many paralyzed people have not probably associated with those tests that they got that Gerald Ford of the Warren Commission was using for political reasons to create an image and for no other reason. And he had been advised that it was dangerous. He was told it was dangerous according to these documents, and he went ahead with it. Another item about the Korean Airlines, there are quite a few to update for you, but this is a very significant one. Came out December the 7th, 1985. The widows of the commander and his assistant of the Korean Airline Flight 007 have charged that their husbands were paid a large amount of money by U.S. intelligence agencies to overfly the Soviet territory. According to the Japanese publishing company Shueisha, S-H-U-E-I-J-S-A, the widows charged that there was a secret understanding between KAL and U.S. agencies, and pilots were forced to agree to perform the spy operations, the civilian planes doing the spying. Chong I.G., the widow of the plane's commander, said her husband told her before September 83 on that flight that he feared for his life. She said she took out a large insurance policy 2 days prior to the flight and told her he was very reluctant to go. Now, the Gerald Ford swine flu is important to my research on the assassinations because of the Kennedy links. And this KAL story is always of interest to me, because I wrote for Larry Flint the article on the Korean Airline that was in the Hustler February 1984, suggesting that Captain Chung, the husband of this woman, was under a form of mind control and that he was telephonically told to go a certain place and was totally unaware of the consequences or would have acted differently. And when they played back the tapes, the last thing he was saying was just asking permission to go a few thousand feet higher while the Soviets were signaling them and trying to find out what was going on. And he showed absolutely no fear at all of any kind and went on a few thousand feet higher. And then the plane, according to recent revelations, had a bomb on it and exploded. And if this man feared for his life, if he took out large insurance policies, if he knew that they were in danger spying, he could have turned around and zipped out. He didn't have to go into a kamikaze suicidal mission. So I think that based upon his behavior and what happened at the time, I think what I wrote as of August, the plane went down September 1st, 83, and I finished the article by November 83, and then it was in the Hustler February 84. It took 2 months for the legal department to check out every word that I had in the article, and then they proceeded to publish the entire thing as is. So his behavior, thinking he's going to die, is not appropriate. And again, I say I believe he was under a mind control. Now, there have been several articles about the Star Wars secrecy, and that is another area close to my attention because of Daniel Graham's relationship to Fritz Kramer, the mentor of Henry Kissinger, the secret operative Kramer. in Washington, D.C. And there were articles this week that Star Wars, the announcement of Star Wars, completely shook George Shultz, that he was kept in the dark. The significant speech that Ronald Reagan gave March 23rd, 1983, was the culmination of work with Edward Taylor since 1966, when Reagan became governor of California. That was the relationship of the Lawrence Livermore Lab and the intent for the German space Star Wars frontal attack, the first strike for World War III. They were cooking it up way back then, and even a person like George Shultz, part of the Bechtel Corporation, didn't know about it until the speech was given. Now, Edward Teller, who helped write that speech, is on the board of Helionetics that got contracts for Star Wars immediately. He's also on the board of Western Goals with the late Larry McDonald and the soon-to-be late Roy Cohn and the military team, pardon me, that do spying with the local police to get names to round up later or to blacklist for jobs. The operation of Western Goals, a military operation by every sense of the word, considering the staff on it. Shultz was not informed, but Larry McDonald, who I wrote about in terms of the Kennedy assassination, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Edward Teller, as part of the Western Goals operation, was working with Ronald Reagan, and just a short time, several days before the speech was given, they told Shultz what they were going to do, and the escalation of the Star Wars began when Shultz only had 2 days' notice that Teller and the scientists who made the hydrogen bombs and the atomic bombs were going now to the next stage of the Star Wars. It was so secret they didn't want them to know about it. In the San Jose Mercury and a syndicated column in Washington Post also, George Will wrote an article on the anniversary of National Review, William Buckley's paper, another important person in terms of the past political assassinations because his forming Young Americans for Freedom with Robert Morris, the links to Senator Joe McCarthy and the Knights of Malta, to the team in Munich, Germany that came with General Walker to the Dallas area to work with the John Birch Society and the American Volunteer Group, H.L. Hunt, and their teams. Buckley formed the YAF with Charles Willoughby, Mr. Carl Wiedenbach from the Kriegsacademy in Germany. And they had an anniversary this week in Washington for William Buckley's 30th anniversary. And George Will has a large article, a statement saying, it will be impossible to write a history of America in the last half of the 20th century without acknowledging the weight of William Buckley's work. And he's absolutely right, because Buckley then links to E. Howard Hunt and Donald Segretti and the James McCord teams, Frank Sturgis, going back to Dallas to the assassination network that has wiped this country out of its leaders and its brains. Now, there's a lot of current controversy going on in Washington of the switch of the chief advisor of the National Security Council, and I even heard a discussion on CNN. It was on the strangeness of the appointment, because the Constitution never provided for a pecking order of the National Security Council, and that's one of the things that I have hammered away at for the last years, because it was set up to negate what Congress thinks or wants, and the balance of power is kilted to the very people from Nazi Germany who helped set up the National Security Council, Reinhard Gehlen, and the German officials working with our American team to make a provision that foreign policy be removed from those natives from the 50 states and be put in the hands of people like Mr. Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger, or admirals, and Admiral Bobby Inman and now Admiral Pondexter. Now, Robert McFarlane doesn't fade away. McFarlane was a protege of Henry Kissinger, and now he's going to belong to the staff of Kissinger Associates. And they, along with Alexander Haig, will try to push Haig's presidential nomination, I mentioned last week. But there is a lot of power, if only from blackmail, from McFarlane, Kissinger, and Haig to keep a good, healthy argument going on in Washington and overseas, because the Kissinger Associates, through Peter Drucker and Fritz Kramer, is as powerful as any single nation. And they wield the influence of the multinational corporations in ways beyond which you can imagine. So they represent the business end as against the Congress and the American people as individuals seeing their factories go overseas or the factories closing, and the choice, multinationals deciding who will get money from the International Monetary Fund, and the businesses become bigger than the countries. That was the theme of Paddy Chayefsky, the late Paddy Chayefsky, who died, and stated that in the movie Network about the corporations. There are no countries. There's Dow Chemical and Exxon and so forth, and ITT. There are not nations anymore. The big boss is telling the radio announcer there are simply corporations. So Kissinger Associates and Bud McFarlane and Alexander Haig and Fritz Kramer and Peter Drucker can merge these huge corporations just as if they were their personal clients. The countries become their clients. That ad I talked about regarding Peter Drucker's book says he's an advisor to nations. When Mr. Neves, Tancredo Neves, was murdered in Brazil on the eve of a new democracy, Kissinger Associates moves in to take over as their client, the country of Brazil, who's been under a military dictatorship for years, and then Kissinger steps in to, in quotes, advise them and to watch their activities, their banking scandals, and their drug traffic scandals. Now, I haven't updated the story of Aja. There's very little news coming out of Rome. There are a few articles. Ever since Aja said on the stand that the people behind his cooked-up story were from Henry Kissinger and National Security and White House, there's been a blackout on the news on Aja. There was a small item just this last week. A convicted Italian racketeer told the court last week that Italy's intelligence agency, and this is very important for references I'm going to make later, SISMI, SISMA, they worked with leaders of organized crime, which is the drug connections. Those are the important mafia drug connections. And they prompted Aja, who's a Turkish fascist, to implicate Bulgaria in the plot to assassinate the Pope. Giovanni Pandico, P-A-N-D-I-C-O, told the court that he personally attended meetings in the Italian jail between General Pietro Musumeci, M-U-S-U-M-E-C-I, Musumeci, the former deputy chief of military intelligence, and he is the link to the Masonic Lodge, to Alexander Haig, to Francisco Pazienza, to Michael Ledeen, and I'll be mentioning more about him. He's the former chief of the military intelligence, met with Aja. He and other intelligence chiefs were convicted earlier this year of subverting the agency for illegal purposes. That's the P2 scandal and the arms and drugs traffic scandal that they're embroiled in. Pandico said the goal of their effort was to persuade Aja to accuse the Bulgarians and then, of course, in turn, to accuse the KGB that the assassination attempt would be placed upon the Russians on trying to kill the Antichrist. The Russian Antichrist would kill the Pope, the good Polish Pope, the Auschwitz Pope, who worked for IG Farben during World War II at Auschwitz. That saint of a Pope would be shot or, in quote, sacrificed, and the nasty Russians would be responsible. We had that Cold War strategy going continuously in the past few years, the KGB lie about the attempts to shoot the Pope, and also the story that the Korean airline was innocently a passenger airplane shot down by the bad Russians, and goodness knows there was a lot of media coverage on the bad Russians. Now I'm going on to the one spy story for the remaining of the program, and maybe next week, because I can't cover it all in 1 week, and it's one continuous pattern, and I want to take it slowly with you and carefully. I'm going to ask you to learn some more new names, to think of some new ideas. Just as I work together my Watergate story or my SLA story and the KAL, I've put a lot of time into this. So sit back and concentrate. I hope you're taping it. If not, you can get a tape and follow it up later because it's very important. There have been a lot of spy stories, and I haven't mentioned any on World Watchers. Several I will in the future, but there is one now of tremendous interest that we have to follow at this time. There's a literal panic that's begun regarding Jonathan J. Pollard. Pollard attended Stanford University and went into intelligence. He was in Israel and offered Israeli service for spying for them, then was part of the American intelligence system. Pollard and his wife of only 4 months. He's only been married to her since the fall of this year. They were married in Rome. They are allegedly freebasing cocaine openly in Washington, D.C., talking their mouths out about their spying jobs. They both got arrested November 21st after leaving the Israeli agency. Now, according to the accounts, Pollard wasn't part of a larger espionage team. He's described as a one-man and his wife, a man and woman team, although she's only been married to him, as I say, for 4 months. And he's been working, allegedly, with one man in Israel by the name of Raphael Elton, R-A-F-A-E-L-E-L-T-A-N. And you're going to hear a lot about him. It's a connection of Pollard, allegedly the loner Navy intelligence spy, and Elton, the alleged loner Israeli spy, that makes this story of utmost importance. And I'll tell you why. The newspaper this morning, the San Francisco Chronicle, December the 9th, taken from the Washington Post, explains the anxiety or hints to the anxiety about this case. It's titled, Ex-Israeli Envoy in Washington to Confer on Spy Investigation. Israeli Cabinet Minister Moshe Arons, the former ambassador to the United States, returned to Israel yesterday from an unpublicized visit to Washington to question U.S. officials about the case of Pollard. Arons, a minister without portfolio, met last night with Prime Minister Shimon Peres, Foreign Minister Yitzhak Shamir, Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin to discuss their case against Pollard, a former civilian intelligence analyst for the U.S. Navy. Official sources said the purpose of Aaron's trip, and these are the top bosses of Israel, this is not a minor matter, the purpose was to establish the limits of interviews that a team that the U.S. Justice Department will conduct. They're setting the limits of the interviews, interestingly enough, that they will conduct this week with two Israeli diplomats who also left this country, they're from the embassy, and went back to Israel, and their contacts with Raphael Eitan, the same man I mentioned before, a former advisor on counterterrorism to Mr. Peres and former Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Eitan, a former operations chief of Israel's External Intelligence Service, the Mossad, was the senior Israeli official involved in recruiting Pollard and continuing his alleged espionage activities. Trade Minister Ariel Sharon, Elton's close political ally and former supervisor in the Prime Minister's Office of National Security in the 70s, is understood to have indicated to Peres that he will not oppose dismantling the offices headed by Eitan that operated under the cover of a technical data gathering office called Science Liaison Bureau. The U.S. investigating team is headed by State Department legal advisor Abraham Sofer. They are also sending Joseph D. Gernova, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Deputy Assistant Attorney General Mark Richard, John Martin in charge of espionage. They're all going to Israel. In addition to Eitan, E-I-T-A-N, the U.S. investigators will question the two diplomats, as I say, who left. They also are questioning whether Pollard sold documents to Pakistan, which he said he did. All of the fuss has been about Israel, not Zia, the dope dealer, the head dope dealer from Pakistan. And also they're wondering about East Germany, a country has not been mentioned that he is giving documents to, but the East Germans would be the Reinhard Gehlen people inside Germany, who are giving the Soviet Union a hard time all of the time. There are a lot of Nazis, former Nazis, right-wing people, and I'm talking about the most right-wing element of the Israeli government, nothing else but. Now, to get to Pollard and his co-partner in Israel, I just want to update a few stories about Joseph Mengele, because this case links directly to the whole Mengele fiasco that's been taking place and the hot potato that these people are going to have to deal with. Ever since the Bango Ambrosiano collapse with Roberta Calvi hanging in London of June 82, the powers that be have been really scrambling around. and in the fall of 82, DeLorean was arrested. In January of 83, Klaus Barbie was arrested, and I had on the air from that time, the past 2 years, the links of Barbie and DeLorean to money in Joseph Mengele's bank account. And I'm following Mengele every week with you, as many stories as there are, because it is very important to the shuffling of these various people and links to the Pollard case, and also to this Ernest Kaiser that I've been talking about, particularly 2 weeks ago, that I have to update more with you. Now, in the San Francisco Chronicle and Monterey Herald syndicated Jack Anderson, November 19th, he has a small item, tantalizing evidence. Those who still don't believe that Joseph Mengele drowned and was buried in 79 have evidence to prove that the remains exhumed were a hoax, but it's a very, very big if. The evidence is a wartime electrocardiogram, an EKG of Mengele. Though an EKG can be as good as a fingerprint by identifying a living person through their heart rhythms, it's no good on dead people or bones. But the EKG could prove that someone living today is really Mengele if it matched the EKG that was dated. The one after 1979 would match the one that they have earlier. So he's saying that there is evidence around in case he's available or even found dead. It wouldn't help then, but if he were ever found alive. Now, to Jack Anderson's credit, he is probably one of the few people keeping this story in the news. The Los Angeles Herald Examiner, November 17th, had a story, ex-president backed by military becomes the mayor of São Paulo in Brazil. 8 months after Brazil returned to a civilian rule, a former president won election as the mayor of São Paulo. Now, that's the controversial nest of Nazis, of the Bossards, of Tommaso Busetti, where he fled and now is testifying in Palermo and in New York. Busetti has direct links through the Merrill Lynch Bank and E.F. Hutton to George Bush's brother-in-law, Scott Pierce, and also to the chief of staff, Donald Reagan, through Merrill Lynch. But the former head of the right-wing forces, he lost as a presidential candidate, but now he's the mayor in a very controversial city of São Paulo while this activity is going on. The Houston Post had a story on Mengele. It updates what I read to you about the group in Terre Haute, Indiana, that met, who do not believe that Mengele is dead, and they have 6 points that they brought out their meeting that were repeated in the Houston Post. This paper is just wonderful for information. They asked, one, whether the bones found in the Mengele grave showed any evidence of osteomyelitis, a disease he suffered in his youth. Two, whether the blood type could be determined from the remains would match Rolf Mengele, the son, who is currently living in West Germany. Three, which witnesses did the pathological team use to verify the bones, and whether the team relied on Mengele's friends to reach their conclusion. The team relied entirely upon Mr. and Mrs. Bossert and Mr. and Mrs. Stammer, both of them of the Nazi Odessa, to come to their conclusions. Third, they said they want to know the status of the investigation in post-1979 sightings. Who were the people that they saw? Who were the witnesses who thought they saw Mengele? Five, whether the clothing found in the grave had been analyzed to determine if it was placed there the same time as the bones. And questions, six, about whether the legs are really shorter than the other, as the bones in the grave indicated. Did Mengele have one leg shorter than another? Now, a New York attorney by the name of Gerald Posner chaired this panel, and they listened to 20 witnesses and took 25,000 words of testimony, doubting the fact that Joseph Mengele is dead. And this is very important to the shifting sands, as I say, that are taking place now in this spy story. Jack Anderson, in his newsletter, November 85, says, despite the near certainty expressed by officials that the skeletal remains in Brazil were those of Dr. Joseph Mengele, I predict the search for the infamous war criminal will continue. Forensic experts who announce with such certitude that the bones were Mengele's have taken an unusually long time to prepare their final report on the investigation. Meanwhile, West German prosecutor Hans Eberhard Klein told me he still hasn't closed his investigation. One question he wants resolved in the medical mystery, Why was there no evidence of bone disease that Mengele was known to have had as a child? Why didn't the scientists check it out? Did they or didn't they? Klein has asked the scientists to go back and check that out. We'll take a one-minute break and then go on from Mengele to some more stories, the spy story, the Israeli story, and where they come together. That is the big story in the news today.